Rain showers mixed with snow showers through the day. No accumulation, a high of 39. Right now it's windy, wind northeast at 16, gusting to 24, 39 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be examining the life and career of one of the most successful head coaches in NFL history, George Allen. Actually, his entire coaching career spanned six decades, from the late 1940s until his death in 1990 at the age of 73. And even though George Allen never managed to win a Super Bowl, he actually never had a losing season as an NFL head coach, and his percentage of games won is among the highest of all NFL coaches. He was also an innovator in many, many ways, and all that and more is explored in a fascinating, massive, and meticulously researched new biography of him called George Allen, A Football Life. The author is Mike Richman, a journalist who has, for the most part, covered sports for the last quarter century or so. The author of, among other things, Washington Redskins Football Vault, The History of a Proud Franchise. And this book is published by University of Nebraska Press, and it includes quite an array of impressive photographs. Its title again, George Allen, A Football Life. The author, Mike Richman. So I wonder if you undertook this project with any sense of trepidation, in the sense that obviously you were and remain a ferocious fan of this football team with whom he is primarily associated, and were and remain a big fan and admirer of George Allen. And sometimes when we more closely examine who somebody is or what they did or how they treated people, sometimes what we find can be disconcerting and maybe sort of eat away at the kind of heroic image that that we have maybe constructed about who they are. I wonder, going into this and through the course of it, if that was ever a concern about doing this, and whether or not, as you came out the other end of this long process, how your just sort of personal feelings about George Allen maybe changed?
To answer that, it's certainly crossed my mind, but it wasn't anything that would have prevented me from embarking on the project. I know George Allen's faults as a coach pretty much, you know, on the surface. I learned a lot more in researching him in this book. But so I knew about his unethical ways as a coach and his terrible relationships with the owners of other NFL teams. I knew all of that going into the book. And I think one thing that helped, that did not make any of this a surprise to the family, is the family agreed to give me unfettered access to really anything I wanted, including the collection, plus all, any interviews that I needed, in return for them reviewing the manuscript beforehand. And they really didn't change anything, and you know, that was not flattering toward their father. These were the kids. They didn't really change any of that. I mean, there was just so much in there that painted a non-flattering portrait of George Allen. I didn't sugarcoat anything. I certainly did not approach it like that. I mean, he used the same draft picks for different players. He was a spy. I mean, he was known as the top espionage coach in the NFL. I mean, would spy on other teams. There were just so many unethical things that he did that rubbed his owners the wrong way. And but no, there was no trepidation on my part at all. And I think the book, the final product, is the real story of George Allen. There's the good, mostly the good, and the bad as well.
I quite agree, and that's one thing I really appreciate. And frankly, I was a little surprised after reading the preface, in which, or at least part of the preface, in which you talk about, you know, what a huge fan you were and remain of this team. I mean, another such super fan might have actually created a portrait of George Allen that might have been nothing but sugarcoating. And I really appreciate that this book is so honest, and that's one thing that makes it really interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mike Richman and talking about his latest book, which is called George Allen, A Football Life. The book focuses primarily on George Allen's tremendous success as head coach of the Washington Redskins from 1971 to 1977, coaching them to 7 consecutive winning seasons. He was also with the LA Rams and the Chicago Bears before that, and his coaching career stretches before that, before his NFL years, and after his time with the Redskins as well. A long relationship with this game that he loved so passionately. One of the themes early in the book would be the difficult circumstances under which he grew up. I mean, not in a sense terribly difficult or dark, but he grew up essentially during the Depression, and some of that deprivation from his early life, you tell us, probably helped shape who he was and his ferocious desire to succeed. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, sure, Greg. So, yes, the very first thing that I wrote in the book is that I quoted George Allen as saying, "I was born motivated." I mean, he grew up during the Great Depression, and he was actually the breadwinner for the house because his father suffered a terrible injury on the factory line. His mother didn't work. So at that time, I mean, he was doing what he can to make money for the family. And so that he developed that tremendous work ethic in his youth, and he carried that forward throughout his life. I mean, that just that detail-oriented nature of him, that workaholic approach, you know, the 16-hour days, whatever, that all started in his youth. And and at the same time, as a kid, he developed a love for sports. He played sports, hockey, ice hockey, basketball. He was a three-sport athlete, actually, at Lakeshore High School in the Detroit area, basketball, track, and football. And he played intramural sports in college. But he really, I mean, he had this dream of somehow making his way into professional sports in some capacity. He knew he couldn't play. He didn't have the athletic ability, but he wanted to be involved in the game. So he just carried that forward. He also had this out-of-the-box thinking in him throughout his life. And let me give you one example of that. He approached Fritz Kreisler. Allen was going for his master's degree at Michigan in 1947. So he approached Fritz Kreisler. He wanted to be an assistant coach on the varsity football team, which was one of the great teams in the country at the time. And Kreisler said, "No, we don't have any room for you, kid." So Allen somehow made another appointment to see Kreisler, and Allen had this stipend from the university. So he said to Kreisler, "Listen, coach, I'll pay you if you give me an opportunity to play on the team." And Kreisler says, "No, you don't have to pay me. We're going to pay you." And that was actually, that meant that Allen was being offered a spot as an assistant coach on the 150-pound midget team at Michigan, which was in the startup four-school conference at the time. And so that was actually his very first assistant coaching job. It was that out-of-the-box thinking, that daring, that you know, somehow, some way, I'm going to make it happen.
Right.
And he carried that attitude forward in life.
By the way, I'm so glad you mentioned that team in which he kind of first dipped his toe into coaching responsibilities. I'd never heard of anything like that. I mean, can you tell us more about exactly this kind of team and how common this kind of thing was with with all smaller players?
I can't say whether it was picked up elsewhere in the country, but there was a four-team conference in the Midwest, and I think Wisconsin was one of the schools in there. I think it was Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Iowa, if I'm correct. Or I'm sorry, Ohio State was in there too. But it was four schools, and so yeah, that was Allen's first assistant coaching job. He was an assistant on the 150-pound midget team at Michigan, and from there he got his first head coaching job at the college ranks when he went on to a Morningside in Iowa. But and also this is another example of Allen thinking out of the box and saying that, you know, anything is possible. To get that head coaching job at Morningside, he rode away to about 800 college coaches around or 800 schools around the country seeking a job, and two wrote back, one of which was Morningside. And Morningside, and Allen thought that he was going to be interviewed for an assistant coach at Morningside. It ended up that the head coach at Morningside quit. He got a job in radio or something. And so Allen was actually interviewed for the head coaching job at Morningside, which he ended up being hired for. So, but that was George Allen throughout his life. I mean, he wanted to you know, do better than everyone else. So there was just the drive that he had, and it was that that nerve, you know, that nothing is going to defeat me. That's the attitude that he carried with him.
Tell us, tell our listeners, that is, about the ultimate move that he makes to the NFL, and actually maybe ahead of that, he does enjoy some success at both the Morningside College and Whittier College over the course of, I think, just under 10 years. He's actually essentially forced to resign, if I remember correctly, from that coaching position at Whittier College over money, over financing, over the money he spent. And I only mention that because that ends up being kind of an interesting foretaste of some of what will end up causing trouble for him when he becomes an NFL head coach some years later. Tell us a little bit about how that particular chapter of his life in football ended.
Right. Well, I wrote in the book that that's really the only thing you could have concluded, is that he was forced to resign from Whittier. Right. In part, it stemmed from his he was handing out all these college scholarships. I don't think the administration liked that. They also didn't appreciate, even though he had a winning record at Whittier, and he had a winning record at Morningside as well, he wasn't the most exciting coach. I mean, it was like a 3 yards in a cloud of dust offense, and apparently the players didn't appreciate it that much. And there was some type of rebellion. They wanted him out. The administration, you know, he fell out of favor with the administration. So he was basically forced out of Whittier. But at the same time, he knew Sid Gilman, the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams at the time. He knew Gilman because, again, George Allen, making his way into the Rams' summer training camps in California, he found a way to get in and see what was going on, participate in the coaching activities. And so he came to know Gilman, and Gilman hired him as an assistant coach in 1957 with the Rams. Allen, interestingly, was hired as the offensive ends coach for that Rams team, although he was a defensive-oriented coach. And he lasted for one season with the Rams. And there's nothing that I could pinpoint saying that he was actually fired from the Rams, but that's really the only thing you could have concluded, because he left that Rams job after one season without another coaching job lined up. So, but that's how that whole sequence evolved. And then he was out of coaching for a few months, and he also... He came to know George Halas. Allen was involved at the time. He was selling golf clubs. He ran a car wash in the Los Angeles area. He was selling these weighted footballs. So he was going to the training camps and practice sites of the NFL teams. And one team that he visited was the Chicago Bears. And there was an assistant on the Bears who encouraged Allen Halas to hire him. And Halas actually eventually brought him in as a spy for two late games in the 1958 season to spy on the Rams, who Allen knew quite a bit about from having coached there in 1957. So Allen was brought in as a spy for those two late-season games between the Bears and the Rams. And then Hollis hired him as an assistant. He was like the head talent scout, hired in that capacity in 1959.
Hmm. Tell us more about what it means to be a spy on behalf of a certain team. I mean, first of all, was that something that was to any extent done above board? I mean, like, if we would have looked at the records of the team of the Chicago Bears, would George Allen have been listed as a spy? Or was this something that had to be sort of done? I mean, obviously the spying part had to be done surreptitiously, but I mean, was this activity that was permitted and lawful, or is this, you know, in a sense, kind of a dirty secret done by NFL teams at this point in time?
Well, this is very secretive. I mean, it certainly was not condoned by the NFL in any way. But yeah, it was done. It was under the table, and but Hollis was actually known for that himself, and I'm sure Allen picked up some of his bad ways, one of which was the spying. But then later on, when Allen became the head coach, he had that trait as well. And in particular, he was known as a spy, or he would tap his assistants to spy on the Dallas Cowboys. And in fact, I interviewed Bob Lilly, the great Cowboys defensive tackle, about this, and he said, "Yeah, we were always concerned about the Redskins spying on us during the George Allen days. In fact, our practice site was within somebody could look at it with binoculars onto that practice site from a local building or something." So he said, "Yeah, we were really concerned about the Redskins spying on us." Now, whether that really happened, in truth, who really knows? But it certainly was out there that George Allen was the top spy in the NFL. And in fact, there's one very funny part in the book where Weeb Eubank, the head coach of the New York Jets, this was around 1972, he said we started practicing at Rikers Island in New York. You know, there's a big jail site on Rikers Island. So he said, "Let's see Allen sneak somebody in there."
Well, ultimately,
so, he was known as the top spy. And you know what other unethical things that he did? Like he would sign players for a day or two and pump them for information about the opposing team, and then let them go. There's like this one story that he met somebody on his staff met a player in the airport, and they got the information they wanted from him, and then they cut him immediately, or they let him go immediately. So, that was George Allen.
So his position with the Bears ultimately undergoes some change, in that he ends up shifting his energies towards being essentially a talent scout, and he ends up being a really, really good one. And one of the things you recount in the book is what he could point to in terms of the amazing players who he helped bring aboard. I mean, some of the greatest players who have ever played the game, in a sense, George Allen can take credit for scouting them. Although I suppose, you know, someone might argue that just about anybody should have been able to spot the greatness of the likes of a Mike Ditka or a Gale Sayers. But clearly he had some real ability when it comes to that.
He did. I mean, he had a very keen eye for young talent when he was the head talent scout for the Bears. I mean, like you said, Ditka, he led the drafting of him in 1961. He drafted Sayers and Butkus with back-to-back picks in the first round in 65. Now, yeah, you would think that anybody would have, you know, who's a general manager would have an eye for that. But still, I mean, you can't take any of the credit away from Allen for doing that. Sayers and Butkus entered the Hall of Fame. They were first ballot inductees. Now, also to really, fortify the belief that Allen had that great eye for young talent. In that same 65 draft, in the first round, he led the drafting of a player named Steve DeLong, who opted to play for the San Diego Chargers in the AFL. He was a one-time Pro Bowler. He was an offensive lineman. Also, Allen led the drafting of Oh, it was, he was a running back that later signed with the Patriots in the fourth round. He was a two-time Pro Bowler and two-time first-team All-Pro. So, Jim Nantz, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So that, and he was signed in the fourth round. With those four players combined in that one draft, you could say, you could arguably say that is one of the greatest drafts in NFL history. Now, I wouldn't say it's as great as the 74 Steelers drafting four future Hall of Famers in that draft, but it was a great, great draft. And so the paradox about Allen is when he became a head coach in the NFL, he focused mostly on veteran talent. I mean, that's, and I asked Bruce Allen about this. I was so curious about it. You know, why with this, you know, such a keen eye for young talent with the Bears, why switch the focus to the veteran players when he became a head coach? And Bruce basically explained it like, when he became a head coach, he felt there was so much of an immediacy to win. And you have to think back in that era. I mean, the pressure was building on head NFL coaches to win right away. I mean, it wasn't like it is today. I mean, one season and you're out. But Allen, he felt that pressure, and he felt that with veteran players, they would give him the greatest opportunity to win right away. And he had this ability to acquire these veterans who, I mean, he could just like almost, he had them in his Rolodex. And I'll give you one example. Roosevelt Grier, one of the fearsome foursome, and Allen inherited that fearsome foursome when he became the Rams head coach. He went down with he tore an Achilles tendon in the 67 preseason. Allen immediately acquired Roger Brown, the great defensive tackle for the Detroit Lions, who had basically their own fearsome foursome as well. He got Brown in, you know, to play for the Rams. He traded, he paid a heavy price for it, but he got Brown in to play for the Rams, and the Rams, the fearsome foursome, kept rolling along. And that 67 team, as I mentioned earlier, I believe that was Allen's best team as an NFL head coach, that 11-1-2 Rams team. So, yeah, that was the paradox about George Allen. So he had this religious-type focus on veterans as a head coach in the NFL.
Right. Even though he had this clear talent for spotting talent in young players, he ultimately went another way when he was finally an NFL head coach. Briefly tell our listeners about the rocky shift from the Chicago Bears over to the Los Angeles Rams. That is the way in which Bears coach George Halas did not want to let him go.
That is correct, yes. So after the 63 championship game, which the Bears beat the Giants 14-10, and that was a, you know, defensive-oriented Bears team, and like I mentioned, Allen was he was heralded as the architect of that Bears championship. He was a hot commodity in the NFL. But Allen didn't seriously pursue any head coaching jobs at that point. But then as the years went on, we come to, like, following the 65 season, Allen felt it was time. He wanted to become a head coach. I mean, he was 46 years old at that point. I mean, this was his moment to make that, you know, take that step forward. And so he accepted the head coaching job with the Los Angeles Rams, who had just fired their coach. And Dan Reeves, the Rams owner, hired him. But Halas didn't appreciate it. Halas said, George Allen has this proprietary information. We don't want him sharing it with other teams, so we're not going to let him go. And in fact, I did see the contract, his Chicago Bears contract. That was something else, a document that was in that Hall of Fame archives. And sure enough, there was a paragraph in the contract that did state that Allen had this important knowledge of the, you know, X's and O's of the Bears and whatever. So Halas didn't want him sharing that with other teams. Halas took him to court, Cook County Circuit Court in the Chicago area, and charged him with breach of contract. And actually, the judge ruled for Halas, but Halas immediately dropped the case. I mean, he didn't want any financial settlement or whatever. He didn't want to retain Allen. He said, George Allen is free to go to the Los Angeles Rams or any other team that he wants to go to. Actually, this was not the first time that Halas had pulled this stunt or had stiff-armed an assistant coach from going to another team. There was an assistant that he had, Hartley Hunk Anderson, in the early 50s that wanted to go to another team as well, and he prevented him from going. And actually, he was successful at this instance. But this time around, Allen had the backing of Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, and Halas eventually gave him the freedom to go to any team he wanted to. But in that whole case, Halas looked like a petulant child, and he was just and it was like, why are you preventing somebody from a promotion like this in the NFL? It's sort of like an unwritten rule or an unwritten type of approach that assistant coaches should be allowed to go from team to team. So I think Allen actually came out the winner in that whole case.
Well, he certainly enjoys some spectacular success with the Los Angeles Rams, but it is also a turbulent time in which he is at odds most of his time there with one Dan Reeves, whom you say were polar opposites in their beliefs of how to run an NFL team. And you go on to talk about how they had distinct personalities and priorities, very different from each other. Tell us a little more about this acrimonious relationship. I mean, who Dan Reeves was and in a sense, why there was such tension between them. Tension which, of course, eventually erupted with the infamous firing of George Allen.
Yes. So, exactly. They were polar opposites in terms of personality. Number one, Reeves was a drinker, and he liked to party. So, and he had his assistant, he would gather with his assistant coaches and some of his players, and they would go out and, to the bar. Allen didn't do any of that. I mean, he was a teetotaler. He just did not drink. He didn't care about any of that stuff. I mean, his sole focus was football and improving the Los Angeles Rams. Reeves, and at the same time, Reeves was in charge of the draft, and Allen was in charge of the active roster. So Reeves did not appreciate how Allen was paying all this money for veteran players. Let me give you one example of something that really irritated Reeves, and I think led to Allen's first firing after the 1968 season. Reeves led the drafting of UCLA Hall of Fame quarterback Gary Beben in the 1968 draft. Allen immediately traded him to the Washington Redskins. Allen knew that Beben couldn't play in the NFL. I mean, he was basically a hybrid quarterback in college. He didn't have the ability to be an NFL quarterback. So Allen traded him to the Redskins, where he flopped. I mean, he never truly played quarterback there. Reeves wanted him, Beben, in part to, he thought he was going to, sell a lot of tickets to the for fans to come to the L.A. Coliseum. Allen didn't want any part of that, so that irritated Reeves as well. And Reeves didn't also he didn't like the fact that Allen also traded Bill Munson, the backup quarterback, to Roman Gabriel. Reeves really liked Munson, so all of those things kind of combined, and Allen's spending ways, of course, factored in there. That led to Allen's first firing after the 1968 season, and that is one of the court case, that is another surreal moment in Allen's coaching career. He called for a press conference shortly after the firing, and he told his Ram players about it, and about 20 of them came to the press conference, and they included his veteran stars, Roman Gabriel and Deacon Jones and Merlin Olsen and Ed Metter. And these guys basically said, "Listen, Dan Reeves, if you don't rehire George Allen, we're quitting."
It's incredible. You called it a public relations nightmare for Reeves. And of course, he had hired George Allen at a point when George Allen was doing incredible things with the Rams. And and ultimately, of course, he did reverse that decision. And George Allen does continue with the Rams for a time and continues to do great things. I want to just touch briefly on a couple of things that by this point we're already seeing some things that were fairly unprecedented in terms of George Allen's style of coaching and the kind of things he did. You tell us that George Allen was one of the first head NFL coaches to launch a drug education program for his players. And, of course, now that just kind of goes without saying. It's an indispensable part of the operation of any NFL team. But George Allen was either the first or one of the first to see the importance of that.
Right, exactly. And the team doctor was in on it with him. They didn't want the players involved in amphetamines or any other types of pep pills or any which were used throughout the league at the time. But they didn't. If it was going to happen, it wasn't going to be condoned by the team itself. I mean, they would have to get it on their own. The team was not going to administer any of that. So yes, he was one of the first, if not the first, coach to have a program like that. He wanted his players educated to the dangers of taking substances like that.
Mm. You also tell us that George Allen was really the first NFL head coach to give so much emphasis to special teams. Apparently, really nobody else in his era gave attention to special teams the way that he did.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about his legacy. I mean, he was a defense and special teams oriented coach. With special teams, he put so much emphasis on that part of the game. He would depend on his special teams for at least two wins per season. And a perfect example of that is a next to last game in the 1967 season. The Rams trailed the Green Bay Packers late in that game, 24-20, and Tony Guillory, a backup linebacker for the Rams and their special teams captain, he blocked a punt late in that game, and the Rams recovered, went down on the 5-yard line. Roman Gabriel throws a touchdown pass to Bernie Casey, later the actor, and the Rams win that game. That was a huge, huge emotional win for Allen. It was one of his most dramatic regular season victories as a head coach. I would put it up there with the 1973 Monday night win, the Kenny Houston tackle. But and then the week after that, they beat the Colts, an 11-1-2 Colts team, and played in the first round of the playoffs that year against the Packers. Allen, that was one example of Allen's special teams. He hired one of the first special teams coaches in Dick Vermeil in 1969, the same year the Eagles hired Marv Levy, who Allen later hired as a special teams coach in Washington. There's another example of his foresight with special teams. In the 1976 season, Allen phoned Bill Malinchek, who was then a commodities broker on Wall Street. And Malinchek was like a master punt blocker for the Redskins from like 1971 through 74. He blocked so many punts. But he was retired at this point. Allen said to Malinchek, "Listen, we want you to come back in for our late season run. I know you're going to do something great." Sure enough, in the season-ending game that year in 1976, Malinchek blocked a punt. He blocked Danny White's punt. Danny White was the punter for the Cowboys, and the Redskins won that game 27-14 and made the playoffs that year in 1976. So Allen he was ahead of coaches, his peers in the NFL in terms of special teams. It was kind of like the opposing coaches looked at special teams like, it's just something they wanted to let's get it over with. You know, go in there, return the kick or whatever. We just need to get this over with. They didn't really put the emphasis on special teams like he did. He actually introduced his special teams on a Monday night game, which really irritated Roselle, the NFL commissioner. He really wanted his special teams to get the recognition that they deserved.
Hmm. One of the things you tell us in the chapter, Mr. Allen Goes to Washington, is Allen loved the thrill of resurrecting teams with a history of losing. And he manages to do that with the Washington Redskins in a really spectacular way. And of course, in your book, you chronicle exactly how he does that. I wonder if you would mind just a brief diversion from what we're talking about right now. I mean, it has to do with this fabled NFL team. I was really struck by, because of course, we all know about the controversy that ultimately led to that name Redskins being removed from the team. One of the things you mention in the book is that George Allen had quite a history when it comes to Native Americans and having concerns for them. and reaching out to especially impoverished Native American communities and really trying to do good for them. I was really struck by that, and I'm glad you included that in this chronicle about his life.
Yes, I think it's a very important part of Allen's life that needed to be told. He had an affinity for Native Americans, starting when he was the head talent scout, defensive coordinator for the Bears. He created a scholarship fund for a Native American tribe in South Dakota, and I believe it was called the Red Cloud Scholarship Fund. And he went in with Dizzy Trout, Detroit Tigers pitcher, but they created that fund, and it would help fund, like, they brought athletic equipment to the reservation, and they did what they could for that tribe. But he carried that on throughout his life, and he wanted to benefit them in any way he could. And actually, there was something similar that he did when he was in Washington too. They would have these banquets and to raise money for Native Americans. In terms of his involvement with the logo, the creation of the logo that existed on the Redskins helmet for nearly 50 years, prior to the 1972 season, a Native American, a prominent Native American named Walter Blackie Wetzel, approached Allen. Now, Wetzel was really well known at the time, and he had been chair of the National Congress of American Indians, and he was president of Blackfeet Nation in Montana. And so he approached Allen. He said, "Listen, I don't really like that R on the Redskins helmet," which actually had been created by Lombardi. That was Lombardi's vision, and he coached the Redskins in 1969. We need a different emblem on the helmet. So Allen asked him what he would like, and Wetzel came back with this composite that looked like a proud Indian chief, the Indian chief as we see it on the Buffalo nickel. So that's what existed on the Redskins helmets for 50 years. So as I've argued in recent years over the name change and erasing the name and retiring the logo, I'm saying, hey, you know, it was a Native American that had this vision of creating the logo. I wanted people to understand that it, you know, it's not this, like, this racist, total racist past of the Redskins that's existed. I mean, there has been this this concern for Native Americans and their desire to cooperate with them and to actually uphold their desires. And this is a perfect example of Allen agreeing to this logo that existed on the Redskins helmets until it was retired in 2020.
Right. One of the things you tell us through the course of the great success that he enjoyed with the Redskins was the fact that when the Redskins, first of all, over the years, the Redskins tended not to perform quite up to their potential in playoffs. And so although George Allen's record in regular season games is quite impressive, it is less impressive in terms of playoffs. And one of the most bitter defeats for George Allen was when the Redskins made it to the Super Bowl but fell to the ultimately undefeated Miami Dolphins with that famous perfect season. And one of the things that you spell out in your book is the possibility that George Allen's fierce, relentless approach to excellence may have actually gotten in his way and undermined the way his team ultimately performed in that important game. Explain what I'm talking about.
I believe that's true. He really, really worked the players hard in the 2 weeks preceding that game. In the first week, which was at Redskins Park, they were these, you know, long practices that he would normally hold. Then the following week, when they were in L.A., it was basically the same approach that he took, and the players were, you know, emotionally and physically drained by the time the Super Bowl started. At the same time, Allen was a nervous wreck prior to that game. I mean, he was having these run-ins with the press. You know, why he had to do these organized press conferences. He first, or Shula, vice versa, and but Allen was really, really angry with the press, and why are you forcing me to do this? And in fact, he would say something like, you're taking time away from me working with my team. You're hurting us. There was one reporter who stood up and said, Coach, you're sounding like a defeatist. And sure enough, that's the way, you know, George Allen came across in those days preceding the game. And I remember quoting one of the players, Brig Owens, who played in that game. And he said, you know, you can't work us so hard in the days leading up to a big game like that. I mean, you need to relax a little bit, lay off it somewhat. But Allen just kept going, and I think that did have an effect on the game. Now, interestingly, that Redskins team was close at the end of that game. I mean, that was 14-7. I'm sure you recall the field goal attempt by Yepremian that went awry, and then it was he batted it up like a volleyball, and Mike Bass ran it back 45 yards for a touchdown at the end of the game. So that made it 14-7. That was another special teams play, by the way. And then so the Redskins had the final possession in that game, but they couldn't tie it up. So the Dolphins secured their 17-0 season. But that was probably Allen's biggest loss. I would also say the 74 Thanksgiving Day loss to the Dallas Cowboys, in which Clint Longley, a backup quarterback nobody knew about, replaced Roger Staubach and led a comeback victory for the Cowboys that day over the Redskins Thanksgiving Day. That was just a huge, huge loss for George Allen. But in terms of him not being able to advance in the playoffs, I definitely explored that in the book. And, you know, he had all these veteran players. So one belief is that those veterans, you know, didn't have the energy to go that extra yard, that basically they couldn't compete with teams that had the younger players that were really good, one being the Cowboys. I mean, Cowboys had Danny White and Tony Dorsett. And they also had a future Hall of Fame quarterback, Roger Staubach. And the Redskins really didn't have an elite quarterback at that time. Billy Kilmer was a good game manager. He made the Pro Bowl one time, but he was not an elite quarterback in the league. One thing that I asked in the book is, what would have happened if Allen had an elite quarterback? Would they have been better? And I think they would have. But it was just a theory that I mentioned about that he didn't have the firepower on it with his players. They were older players, and he didn't have that elite quarterback to really. And he didn't dip into the draft enough. His reliance on those veterans, I think, really did hurt him.
Hmm. Well, and you certainly tell us that's part of what led to kind of the slide of the Redskins. You write at one point, Allen's wheeling and dealing for veteran players drained the team of quality draft picks, giving credence to the early warnings that he was mortgaging the future in exchange for winning immediately. One other quick question. I know I've taken a lot of time from you already. Another way in which George Allen was a bit different from many of his contemporaries is his contentious relationship with the press. And, I mean, it's a good reminder that he came to prominence at a time when there was, by and large, a very positive and probably often maybe too cozy relationship between press and head coaches. But George Allen had his own ideas about how he thought the press should properly function, and it was often a very tense relationship. Just explain what you are saying here.
Right. Well, George Allen was the Bill Belichick of his day, put it that way. Belichick, being so tight-lipped in terms of what he shares with the media. Allen was basically the same way, and he thought reporters were there, the press was there to steal information from him and share it with other teams. So he was very, very careful about what he told them. There was this run-in that he had with the press in particular. Several games into the 1972 season, the Redskins were coming off a loss to the Patriots, and there was a belief that Allen was going to switch quarterbacks from Kilmer to Jurgensen. So he didn't like the fact that the press was reporting that. They were saying that, hey, you know, is he really going to do it? Is he going to switch from Kilmer to Jurgensen? And in fact, he did make the switch, but Allen didn't appreciate that at all. And so he had a very acrimonious relationship with the media. And in fact, his nickname came to be Nixon with a Whistle. Richard Nixon was his good friend, but Nixon also, you know, he disliked the press the same way. You know, he had his enemies list, many of whom were members of the media. So, but yeah, that was George Allen. He did not like the press at all. And actually, I didn't really gather that he showed much of that in Los Angeles. See, Los Angeles was like a four-sport town when Allen coached there, so I don't think there was as much media attention on him. But when he got to Washington, I mean, the Redskins were the only game in town because the Washington Senators baseball team had just moved out, and there was no NHL team or NBA team at the time. So, I mean, he was solely in the spotlight, and so he was just very, very careful what he shared with the press.
Interesting. So at the end of all of this exploration of George Allen and what he meant to the teams that he coached, what is your sort of overall assessment of who he was and of what he achieved?
He was certainly one of the elite coaches in the NFL during his era, from that 66 through 1977 period when he coached in the NFL. He was on par for a long stretch of that period with Shula and Lombardi. So he deserves that type of recognition, and I definitely touched on that in the book. And as his legacy today, he's a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, tremendous innovator in the game in terms of defense and special teams. He introduced defensive schemes that are part of the fabric of today's game, the 5 and 6 defensive backs. And his record, I mean, his statistics, coaching record, speaks for itself. I mean, his 7-12 regular season winning percentage is number 3 all time for coaches with at least 100 victories. He's behind John Madden and Lombardi in that. So he has the coaching, the statistics, the success in his coaching record, particularly regular season, and he's in the Hall of Fame, and he was an amazing innovator. So, somebody needed to write the definitive biography on George Allen. I felt that I was the person to do it and to really bring these facts about him to light. I mean, the fact he had accomplished so much as not only an NFL coach, but USFL coach as well, and his success in college.
Absolutely. I think you were the man for the job, clearly, because you've done a wonderful job with it. It's a terrific book, start to finish. Again, it's titled George Allen, A Football Life, published by the University of Nebraska Press. It includes quite a number of interesting photographs as well to help further illuminate the life and career of this fascinating man. And we have just really skimmed the surface. I mean, just it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of all that is found in this sprawling biography of this fascinating man, the author Mike Richman. Mike Richman, thank you so much for giving the world this really interesting book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. The excellent questions. If I could just mention my website.
Please.
MikeRichmanJournalist.com. That's MikeRichmanJournalist.com. And anyone can get an author autographed copy of the book through my website. It's also available through Amazon and Nebraska Press.
This weekend in the podcast version of The Morning Show, a couple of interesting interviews, including one tomorrow that is quite timely from back in 2011, my conversation with Niall Ferguson, who did an extensive series of interviews with Henry Kissinger for the purposes of a National Geographic documentary. And in the wake of the news of Henry Kissinger's death at the age of 100 this past week, we will replay that conversation with Niall Ferguson on tomorrow's podcast of The Morning Show. And on Sunday, an interesting and fun conversation about the application of math to our daily lives. It's a book called How Math Explains the World. To hear The Morning Show in podcast format, you need to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg, and it's available through all podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. On Monday, in what promises to be an interesting follow-up to last Monday's memorable conversation with David Brooks, the author of How to Know a Person. I'm going to be replaying a conversation from 2022 with the co-authors of a book called Connectable, How Leaders Can Move Teens from Isolation to All In. It's a look at disconnection, but more specifically in the contemporary workplace. Next week's morning shows will include on Tuesday a conversation with Dr. Art Sear, good friend of the morning show, offering his analysis of current events. On Wednesday, we talk about, among other things, the Racine Theatre Guild's production of the musical The Little Mermaid.